I have a lot of information in my head. What I don't have is really a lesson. I don't know how to organize it. So when in doubt, I'll just read the parsha that we're working on and see if anything clicks on the way. Sometimes the questions that get asked lead the class. So if I'm a little disorganized, I apologize. Also, I hope you had a chance to give an afim on Sefer Shoftim.
Yeah.
Because he certainly summed up a lot of what we're doing.
Yeah, all we did was
read Was that? That's right. I said something. Thanks a lot. So now you can start Sefer Shmuel.
That was good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny.
We already know a lot about that too.
What's that?
We already know a lot about that too.
I think he got a sense of it from me, but I definitely got my toe from him. Okay, the story is about Ehud ben Gera. We've finished up the Elvein Knas, so we're on Pasuk Yudbet. I'm just going to read it through because I think it pays to spend 5 or 10 minutes on the story and the story details, and then start to analyze the content and the themes inside the story.
I'm sorry, tell me again what...
We are in chapter 3, verse 12.
Okay. I
didn't think about the turkey. That's so cool. No, verse 12, sorry. Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael la'asot hara b'nei. So the b'nei Yisrael continues to do bad. If you remember, we're talking about the Knaz, they've done bad, they've worshipped the idols. Here the Pasuk never stresses what the evil is, and it's striking in that the details of the sin are not laid out here at all, which leads us to surmise, and whether we'll surmise today or not, I don't know, but it's certainly something worth noticing. And they did bad, and Otniel cannot fix things up. So after Otniel dies in verse 11, they continue to do evil, which is part of the cycle that we spoke about. Vayachazek Adonai et Egron Melech Moav Yisrael al ki asara b'nei Hashem. So essentially, God strengthens Eglon, Melech Moab, on that against Israel, essentially, because Israel had done bad. But yeah, Sophalav and Eglon managed to gather together two other nations, at Bnei Amon v'Amalek. Now, Bnei Amon is a sister tribe or sister nation to Moab. They are, of course, both of the children of Lot by his daughters. The older one had Moab, and the young one had Amon. We're going to see where they are on the map a little bit. I'll show you geographically where they are. But right now, just for the... And it's important geographically what's going on. But right now, just to know that we're on 312. Just to know for now that essentially they get together their sister country. And they also get Amalek. We haven't seen Amalek's ugly people for a while. But here they come back together with Moab to attack Israel. Vayacha Israel, vayirishuit ir hatzmarim. And they inherit. Now here again, there's that word inherit, which I'm intentionally misreading. And they conquer and settle Ir HaTzmarim. Now Ir HaTzmarim, we know what that is. Rashi says it, which is Yericho, that is correct. We know that because at the end of Devarim, when it's laying out some of the borders of Israel, it explicitly says Yericho, Ir HaTzmarim, which means they settle a city that was not settled by the Jewish people, because if you remember, Yericho was destroyed, nobody was allowed to live there. However, there was somebody living there. If you remember back to Paragal, who was living in Yericho at the time? Remember? In Paragal, somebody did go to live in Yericho. Go back to chapter 1, verse 16. Uvnei Keni, the children of Keni, Chotei Moshe, Alu Meir Tzmarim. They got up and went out from Ir Tzmarim, from the city which is Yericho, et Bnei Yehuda, Midbar Yehuda, Sher Benegev Aratz. They leave Ir Tzmarim, which is apparently where they had holed up, which means you can surmise a little bit that Ir Tzmarim, while it was not usable by Jews, was okay for the Canaan would follow the Jews into Eretz Yisrael, the Midianites that had decided to attach themselves to Eretz Yisrael. So here we see that they got up. Now, when this story takes place is very important. It's something that we'll tie together later on, but I thought it might be interesting for you to know. Not only that, we also see, so Eretz Marim here is very interesting. Now, did in Perek Aleph, did they leave Eretz Mitzrayim? Because really Perek Aleph is happening at the same time as Eyub and Gera. We would assume that it happened earlier, that they left by themselves. But then you have to ask the question, why did they bother leave Eretz Mitzrayim? It's kind of a nice place. Why would they go into the southern desert of Judah? Not only that, we'll see a second time the Canaan show up in a different part of the country, which is next week or 2 weeks from now when we talk about Devorah. Devorah, of course, Yael, who also moved, we don't know where they moved from, we could assume Eretz Mitzrayim, but they move all the way up north to Naphtali, around Yam Kinneret, and Yael plays a big part, Clever and Yael, play a big part in the conquest of Israel, helping the Jews conquer Israel there. So there seems to be a connection between Eretz Mitzrayim, Yericho, and the non-Jews who are living there. It actually gets even more interesting in Sefer Malachim, because right after a very famous incident that happens in Yericho, Eliyahu shows up for the first time. The connection between Yericho and Eliyahu is very interesting, but not for now. What happens with the city of Yericho keeps coming back over and over to Tanakh, and it's used in very strange ways, and we'll see it as we, throughout the months or years that we're living. So they conquer Yericho. Now this is different than Kushan Rishathaim. Kushan Rishathaim conquered Israel from a taxation standpoint. He didn't take away any of their property. He simply sent soldiers, and the soldier would say, pay taxes, please. And they would pay taxes very nicely. This is different. For this first time, we see this.
People taxes?
Oh, for sure. For sure, people taxes and money taxes. Here, well, it's a non-Jew doing it to you, not much of a choice. But actually, no, King, that was when Shaul reads the people the rules. Shmuel reads the people the rules about the king. People taxes are one of the eligible items. As a king is allowed, a Jewish king is allowed to conscript people to make them slaves. I don't know. That's correct. I mean, but certainly if it's mutter for us, then obviously there's no law that would prevent them from doing so. Oh, taking people into bondage and demanding humans to work is a theme that runs through all the way through my demonstrations. I'm not sure we have to do today, but it's certainly famous during Roman. Certainly, it's famous during Roman times.
Not considered
I suppose in some ways, if they don't want to come, they're captives. So they're captives of war. But there's also people that they simply have to go and work there and do the job. Where the line between slave and worker stop, you know, where that fine line is, it's hard to say. Probably depends on the quality of the work. What's that? It's true. It depends on the company they work for, absolutely. But here, what we see for the first time is a little degradation. This nation is not only controlling Israel from a financial aspect, but it's actually conquered a part of Israel that the Jews first conquered when they first showed up in Eretz Israel. A significant idea. Let's continue on, though. Pasuk Yud Dalet, verse 14. Vayavdu b'nei Yisrael et Eglon melech Moab, and they served him shmona esrei shana, 18 years. Vayizaku b'nei Yisrael et Adonai, they call it to God, Vayakim Adonai lahem Moshiach, and God sends them a savior at Ehud ben Gera ben Hayimini, Ehud ben Gera from the tribe of Benjamin, ben Hayimini, ben Yamin, Ish Iter Yad Yuno, a man who could not use his right hand, so he was a lefty. Whether Iter means he didn't use it because he was a lefty or he couldn't use it because it was shriveled up is a dispute among commentators, but by and large he was a lefty. And it, by the way, Iter is also a lefty in modern Hebrew is also called an Iter. Vayishlechu b'nei Yisrael b'yado mincha l'eglon melech Moab. And they send in his hand an offering to Eglon, the king of Moab. Vayaslo ehud cherev, he makes himself a sword. V'la shte peyot gomed orka, and it has two sides, a two-edged sword. Gomed orka, and it is essentially, gomed is an amma, it's an almond-like, it's about a foot and a half. So it's rather short, the 16-inch blade, it's a rather short blade. If you're curious to see what it looks like and why it's significant, on the top of this map you'll see a standard blade. Now I didn't draw the size, but you can tell from the hilt the basic size of the blade. On the top is the blades that they've actually dug up from the Shulchan period. That would be your standard blade. You can see two interesting things about it. One is, I would say, it's about 3 feet long, the one on the top. It also has a single edge. You see that? It's a single-edged sword. Why? What's that? And it's curved, much like the scimitars that would continue to be popular during, you know, in the Arab countries. But yes, it is curved, and it has one side. Why? My guess is it's cut through leather. Why did they not use a double-edged sword? Probably because it was too expensive to make. Because to make it sharp on both sides, you require a certain craftsmanship that you didn't have. We're still in the Bronze Age at this point. We have not entered the Iron Age, so there's probably still a limitation on the quality of swords. The swords were probably made out of bronze, which means they weren't all that sturdy. They probably dented pretty nicely compared to the iron swords that would come during David's time. I believe that's when the Iron Age starts, around David's time, but I'm not positive. The sword that Ehud makes looks like something that's on the right-hand side. Now, I cut and paste it larger, but as you can see from the hilt, it's only about twice as long as the hilt is, so it's about a foot and a half. This was not a sword that was dug up during the Shulkin period. This was a sword that was dug up during a much later time. There, as far as I know, based on what I read, they have no swords. There are no archaeological swords found from the Shulkin period that have this short sword period. That doesn't mean that there weren't any. There clearly were. Ehud had one. What it means, though, is that it was uncommon. It was an uncommon weapon. It was an uncommon weapon. Going back to the story, so it had two-edged sword. Gomen Akar was particularly short. Vayakoro Tomi Tafot Madav. And he wore it under his uniform, al yerech imino, on his right thigh. The detail here should either be bothering you or satisfying you, because it's incredible detail. In fact, this whole parsha, keep in mind to the incredible detail that we pay attention to. Very rarely, anywhere else, will we pay close attention to somebody's weaponry, the motions that he takes, the movements that he makes back and forth. There are a few times that we do, such as Goliath. We get a minute description of the clothes that Goliath is wearing, but they're also, it serves a purpose. Most of the time, by Gidon, which is a famous battle, we don't get much about him at all. In fact, what's interesting here in this whole parsha, if you take a look at Perek Gimel, we actually have three Shoftim. We start off with Otniel ben Knaz, we go to Ehud ben Gera, and then we end off at the very end, if you skip to the end, Lamed Aleph, Shamgar ben Anat, who gets exactly one pasuk. Shamgar gets one pasuk. Otniel ben Knaz gets, one, two, three, four, maybe five pasuk. And Ehud's got a whole chapter almost to himself. He's got an entire section, 20 pasuk or so, or more, 25 pasuk. About 25 pasuk. That's right. From Yud Bet, from 12 to 30, 18 pasuk. It's a comparatively large section. Now, normally, what that would speak to you is to say, well, Ehud then was a comparatively important person. The other reason why you might think Ehud is an important person is, while Otniel ben Knaz only ruled for 40 years, take a look at the end in Pasuk Kaf Chet at the duration of Ehud's rule. You see what it says there in Pasuk Lamed in verse 30? How long did he rule for? 80 years. We don't have a ruler anywhere else in Tanakh that rules for 80 years. It's almost unheard of.
Well, they don't really know that he ruled for 80 years, it's just that he's quiet for 80 years.
Fantastic. Terrific. It's a point that I want to drive home even better, but you're absolutely right. Nonetheless, the time of quiet is attributed to him. What's interesting, by the way, is if you flip over to Perek Daled, which we're not going to get to today, if you just go sequentially, which I think is too naive to do, first you have Otniel, then you have Ehud, then you have Shamgar ben Anat. We don't know exactly how long he rules. Do we ever find out how long Shamgar rules? I don't think we really know how long he rules.
It's probably simultaneous.
Ah. Well, what's interesting is, even if you say it's simultaneous, look at the first pasuk in Pasuk Daled, in Perek Daled. Vayosipu b'nei Yisrael la'asot hara b'nei Hashem? Ehud makes. What's Shamgar ben Anat? What is it? Chopped liver? You know? So, but it's an important point. It's saying that all the problems that would come to Devorah of a near destruction of the entire center of Israel, which I hinted at some point beforehand, all of that is caused by Ehud's death. By Ehud's death. So even if you want to say that Ehud didn't live for 80 years, you have a little problem. Because what it seems to be saying is that the Sheket stops, the quiet stops, upon Ehud's death. And then all the troubles of Devorah come up. So the questions that you have from that are, well, again, where was Shamgar? And did Ehud really rule 80 years? If he didn't rule 80 years, what does it mean? Now we've got a problem because Ehud's dead. Well, you could say that Ehud died, I don't know, after 50 years, and then there was 30 years of relative peace and quiet until things went bad. I have a hard time with the fact that Ehud ruled for 80 years. It simply seems unlikely. It means he would have had to start at an incredibly young age and continue until he was an old, old man. I mean, it's true people lived a little longer then than they did now, but still, if you were pushing 100, you were pushing old. You were pushing old. So how far could he have gone and still been a successful leader? It's a shocking number.
Well, things mean that the problem isn't how long he ruled, but how long his influence was, and then how long he was alive. Because I think it takes a little while, if they were behaving properly while he was alive, it takes a little while for everything to go down the tube.
I agree. I absolutely agree. A Pusik Dalit doesn't... Herrick Dalit Pusik Dalit, where the lore starts, does not make it seem like it's a slow degradation. It's sort of like almost an instantaneous change. He was dead, now he got bombed. Nonetheless, and I believe that you're absolutely correct, it doesn't seem likely historically that things would just, you know, you wake up one day and your life is on fire. That's generally not things that work from a geopolitical standpoint. Even by Otniel ben Kenaz, we saw that he was appointed leader, but only at some later time did Hashem infuse him with the spirit of God so he could get up and act on it. So, you know, even there, even though he ruled for 40 years, clearly not all of that was hunky-dory. Nonetheless, I think I'm trying to point out that Ehud seems to be an incredibly powerful player. So powerful that Shamgar ben Anat disappears in his wake. So powerful that his rule, or if not his rule, his influence lasts 80 years. And so powerful that the large point of this dedication before we get to Devorah, which is, you know, her own story really, is, well, twice as large, at least twice, maybe three times as large as Otniel ben Kenaz, who I would have said, based on what I described as being really more of a king, and having an external reach, would have been more powerful than Ehud. In fact, if you take a look at Ehud, and you take a look on the map, Ehud ruled in Binyamin, which is, if you see, about 10 kilometers north of Yam HaMelech, and then about 10 kilometers to the west, and you'll see Yericho. You see Yericho? That's Shevet Binyamin. So the right of it is Moab's territory. Now what's interesting is you can say, wait a second, it's not Moab's territory. Whose territory is it actually? It seems to be God's and Reuben's territory. Moab was below Nachal Arnon, which is halfway down the Yam HaMelech. However, based on the story I'm going to read you, it can't be that Moab ruled just down there. Because the relationship, Ehud runs across the border, he kills him, he runs back, and then he brings an army. So it clearly the action is happening north of the Arnon, most likely in that Arvot Moab area to the east side of the Jordan River. Which means even though the Navi doesn't tell us at all, clearly Moab did not only conquer Yericho, clearly he conquered who else's territory? Reuben's and God's. Yeah. I mean, we don't know it explicitly. The Navi, for reasons that we'll talk about, I think, doesn't tell us, but clearly it's not just one city. Why then mention the one city? Because that's a key city, because that's the first time that they're essentially repeating what the Jews did when they first crossed over into the Jordan River. But the actions happened to the north, so you can see Moab is a powerful, powerful player. But the point I was trying to make is that makes Ehud still a regional power. He's on the other side of where Moab is. He fights them just across the river. Otniel ben Kenaz fought somebody in the north when he lived all the way in the south, and yet Ehud ben Gera gets all these psukim, and I guess the question is why. So let's continue on with the story and see what else we can find out. We are on Pasuk Tetzayin. We finished Pasuk Tetzayin, which is all about his sword and where he wore it. Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17. Vayakrev et hamechala Eglon. He brings the sacrifice, the offering to Eglon, Melech Moab. The Eglon ish barimo, very fat guy, very very fat. By a modern Hebrew word, by the way.
He's healthy.
What's that? Yeah, very healthy. Very very healthy.
Healthy eater.
Well, going back to those ideas, when a fat was a sign of health and wealth, right? That would even go back to guys. Remember, you see pictures of Tycho Brahe. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was. Essentially, Galileo used him as he was an astronomer. He wasn't a theory guy. He was he was an accurate scientist in that he took very close. Not Galileo. Copernicus. Copernicus. I apologize. Copernicus used him as an accurate timekeeper. He would literally just have these gigantic logs. If you see pictures of Tycho Brahe, he's this humongously fat guy. And Copernicus, being a serious Christian, was something they were nasty. So you can see the two guys, one skinny guy who was brought to these parties of Copernicus, of Tycho Brahe. Tycho Brahe was this humongously fat person. And eventually what he did was he choked on his own food and killed over. So he was considered to be very healthy. He had quite a following. But I think I got off the topic a little bit. Pasuk Yudchet. Vayehi kasher kilala krivat mincha. They're finished. They finished bringing the sacrifice to Eglon. Vayishalach et ha'am. No se'enucha. And then everybody's like, go home. Fine. Done with you. V'hu shav min ha'psilim. V'hu is talking about Ehud. He turns back from the psilim asher al ha'gilgal, which are in the Gilgal. Take a look at your map again. The Gilgal is to the southeast, about 5 kilometers southeast of Yericho. So there seems, to my mind, there's no doubt that this is Kalpa Tefer with the Moab nation. Moab nation have conquered into Eretz Israel. They've crossed and taken the fords of the Jordan. They've taken Ir Yericho, and the Gilgal is, well, honestly, it looks more like it's on the Yericho side, like the Moab side, but probably it's a border city between where Israel stops and where Moab begins. And apparently they're Psalim set up. Now, the normal translation for Psalim are, of course, idols. The Mephorshim don't go with that, though, for some reason. The Mephorshim, if you take a look at Rashi by Psalim in Pasuk Yutet, see what Rashi or Adak says.
You think Israel had set up a capital in Yericho?
Not in Yericho. He was clearly across the river. They crossed the river to get to them. But he had set up his capital, probably, our guess is probably the Shittim, which is where Israel camped out before they crossed into the river. That's the guess. He had certainly moved into Reuven's territory as a forward conquest. I mean, that's just what kings did. Either they sent their generals or they sent themselves when they were on their move towards conquest, and that was clearly what everyone had in mind. If you take a look at Pasuk Yutet Psilim, so Rashi translates Psilim as Makom Sheposlim Sham Avanim Menahar. It's quarry. Sheposlim, they chunk off essentially, Avanim Menahar. The Chaim Targum Yonatan, Yonatan says that Minha Machsaviyah, Machatzev is a quarry, is the Hebrew word in Aramaic for quarry. Which means Rashi, for whatever reason, ignores the idol worship. And one can sort of guess why. It never mentioned that they were idol worshippers here. It mentioned that the Jews had done bad things, but it never mentioned idol worship. We're at the very beginning of the Shoftim period, so the idea that the Psalim is a little hard to believe. So Rashi, on the footsteps of Yonatan, ignores the simple translation that they were Psalim. If I'm not mistaken, our doc goes with the same idea. If you have doc, I know there was another parish that said the same thing.
Yes.
The Radak says the same thing? What does he say? Yeah, okay. Right, so the Radak also ignores the idea, and we have that many portion studiously ignoring this simple shot. It's something to think about. What I'll show you in about 20 minutes from now is that I think that Rashi and Radak, I believe that it's possible to understand differently, and the Psalim are in fact Psalim. But then the question is whose Psalim they are. I read an article by Yehuda Elitzur, who's was a famous biblical scholar. A lot of the dot mikras. He wasn't a frum guy, but he was frum in his, you know, in his approach to Tanakh, even though he wasn't a religious guy. He was friends with Rabbi Yehuda Noam. He was really one of the first great scholars of Tanakh in Israel. And if you look in, and he also helped edit the dot mikras. And if you look at, he wrote an article about the whole Ehud incident. He said, Psalim must have belonged to the non-Jews, and they were essentially the border side of the non-Jewish side of Yericho. So he also was uncomfortable with the idea that the Jews had Psalim. It must have belonged to the Moabites. I disagree with all of that, and we'll see why if I manage to get to Mashiach, which I may not.
Is there any mention of God and Reuven involved?
No mention here whatsoever. So totally quiet.
Moab moved into their territory and
gone goodbye.
I think
they rolled over and said thou.
The paragraph here which discusses that issue, it says the word Hapasilim here refers to Cuddle Cross Stone. Some say it means a stone quarry. In fact, that's how it's translated. Others say that the Gilgal referred to here is the place where Yeshua erected the monument. In that case, the word Hapasilim might refer to the monument.
Fascinating.
This would be
I'll get there in a second.
This would be an appropriate name since it was constructed of carved stone. In that case, Ehud might have stopped there briefly to pray that God help him by the merit of the righteous ancestors who had erected the monument.
Beautiful. Except, it's still, what's interesting is, even though it's a slightly different parish, and I want to mention that the Gilgal was not only where the stones had been set up, what was set up first in the Gilgal? The Mishkan. The Mishkan was there for years before Yehoshua dragged it up to Shiloh. Because people were sitting at the Gilgal. It wasn't just the stones that was there. The Mishkan, it was the Aron. Everything was there. So I would have added on to that commentary, but you know what? I disagree with that commentary also, because it's still staying with the theme that these Psalim are not idols, that they are stone emblems, which either denote just the one I'm cracking out of a quarry, or they may include some kind of frum stone, like these
from...
What?
No, they're not Psalim. Like,
They're known, exactly right. Nonetheless, it's surprising that everybody's shying away. Well, not everybody, but most of them are going out of their way to shy away from the idea. How many other places in the Torah will you find Psilim not named Psilim? You can look up and down, you won't find many. You won't find many, if at all. So it's interesting that everybody, even the Me'am Lo'ez here, is avoiding the idea of calling them Psilim. And I think it's because in the time reference that we have, there are no references to Psilim. And therefore, if there are no references to the Jews building Psilim, whose Psilim are there? Which is why Rabbi Yehuda Elitzur said, listen, not Rabbi Yehuda Elitzur, Yehuda Elitzur said, listen, there are Psilim, but they're not the Jewish Psilim. All of these commentaries. What? True, but what's interesting is when Otniel ben Knazi said they vayasu rabbi ne Hashem, it said they worship the Baal and the Ashtaroth. Here it actually avoids it. It just says vayasu rabbi ne Israel. If they would have worshipped idols, it should have said that they were worshipping idols. The very fact that here when it says vayosipu lasod harabbi ne Hashem, and it doesn't specifically mention idols, one could easily come to the conclusion that it wasn't idols. Not only that, Baal Peor, Selim don't really represent Baal Peor. Baal Peor was sort of a Selim are not really what you made for Baal Peor. Baal Peor was, well, I can't say that for sure. I'm not an expert. The Ashtaroth, well, the Ashtaroth were also, Ashtaroth are not referred to as Selim. They're just called Ashtaroth. They are Pesel. They are images of the Earth Mother. And a Baal Peor, I think, also had an image as well, although mostly an altar. Nonetheless, I think the word Selim is also strange. I don't think we see the use of the word Selim with Baal Peor and Ashtaroth. And that, including the idea that it doesn't mention idol worship here, may lead all these Mepharshim to stay away from the idea of Psilim. I want to come back to it, but not yet, because I believe that they are Psilim, and we'll see why I think so, but we'll have to continue on. It may take us 2 weeks to do it, but you know what? He deserves it. Let's continue on. V'hushav, Pasuk Yud Tet, 19. V'hushav mid Psilim. He returns to the Psilim, Asher et HaGilgal, which means he crosses the Jordan River, and then he sends everybody on, and he goes back to across the Jordan River to where Eglon was staying. By Yomer, Dvar Sefer Li Alecha Melech, I had a secret for you, Jordan. Secret for you. By Yomer, Kas. The king says, quiet, quiet. By Yetsu Me'alav Kolom Dimalav. And essentially, the king demands that everybody leave him. Now, the first thing, whenever I read this, I am immediately bothered by it. Why am I bothered by it? I understand he has no visible sword. His sword is underneath his thing. I am aware of that. Nonetheless, King gets up, and he says, you know what? Everybody out so I can talk to the Jewish guy whose country I'm in the middle of conquering. Doesn't that seem a little strange?
He probably thought he was a spy giving him good information.
Well, he probably thought Ehud was working for him. It certainly seems so. But where would he have gotten this idea that Ehud was working for him?
Maybe he did something for him.
Maybe Ehud has a history. But we don't get that history. But one is led to believe that for some reason Ehud is a trusted individual. Why else would he get rid of... I mean, okay, I can see getting rid of most people except somebody, you know? But everybody? And to go to the bathroom, as we're going to find out? I mean, it's a little bit strange that he's willing to have a tete-a-tete with Ehud. It gives his impression he's a history. And yet we have no history of Ehud except the fact that he's one of the guys bringing the mincha. What are the guys bringing him in?
Maybe that's why they think he's got a shriveled thing.
What?
Maybe that's why they think he's got a shriveled thing, because there would then be no threat.
I still agree with that, but doesn't it seem strange that he's willing to put up with a one-on-one? First of all, not everybody says shriveled hand, and I'll prove to you later that it doesn't mean shriveled hand. It just means lefty. It just means lefty. However, even if you want to say that, still, the idea that I'm going to have a one-on-one meeting with a Jew gives me the impression that I have a sense that I have something. I get the sense that he's working for me, maybe.
Yeah,
or
what's
that's
this
a possibility.
Beginning of your tent? It says, but who shot? Doesn't shot mean he returned?
Well, it means he returns because he could be, but it means first he brought him the Mincha, that was on the east bank of the Jordan River. Then he's on his way back because Eglon sent them all home. The Hushav, and he comes back over the Jordan River by himself to go back to Eglon. So you don't have to say that means he was coming from a permanent visit. He was coming from his temporary visit. Let's continue on.
Yeah, by all means. Don't forget, we've got 18 years here. There is a history, right? And this is the guy who has been trusted to bring the man. So it's not as surprising as all that. He's not a stranger to him. There's 18 years of history, and this is the guy who brings him his mincha. It may not be the first time he's brought him.
He may be the leader of the delegation. He's recognized it.
He's the leader of the Jews. The conqueror's the mincha man.
You know, to be honest,
he is their head guy who, 18 years already, he's been bringing me presents. So.
Well, I hear what you're saying, except for the fact that in Pasuk Tet Vav, It says, after the 18 years, and now keep in mind that we've now introduced a new stage in the conquest, which is he's now, probably, by the way, what took place for those 18 years? Reuben and God got it good for about 18 years. There's been a conquest. Now, probably after the 18 years, they've actually entered into the state of Israel.
But he's like, Reuben, before you, Gimel is, you know, Vayakut over here to your mind. Good Dalit is, Vayakut, everyone knows what it is.
Oh, yes, sure, what you're saying is accurate. It could be that he conquered Eretz Marim before. I get the feeling that he's conquering Eretz Marim not just to have the Eretz Marim, but his entrance point into Eretz Israel.
But he did it, I think, prior to the 18 years, that it could be beginning.
It could
be. You don't know when it happened. It seems as if that was when it began.
It could be. And it certainly seems from Pasuk Het Vav that Ehud may be the leader of this group, which is, Vayishlachu ben Yisrael b'yado mincha le'eglon melech Moab. My only problem with this is, not a problem, but right now, just the way I'm thinking, I don't know, it's my opinion, if he's the leader of the Jews, what are the chances that Eglon would want to have a one-on-one with the leader of the Jews that's bringing him a mincha? If he is the leader of the Jews, and that gives the impression that the entire Jewish people who are under Ehud ben Barak are also pushovers, and that's not hard to believe. If he's a leader of the Jews that Ehud doesn't, that Eglon doesn't trust because the Jews are still fighting viciously against him and not allowing him to enter the rest of Israel, then why would you dare let, the leader of the Jews, who's not a leader because he's a nice guy, he's a leader because he's a powerful guy, why would you allow the leader of the Jews to have a one-on-one with you? It would be too dangerous.
Yeah, but he's by himself.
On the other hand,
a leader generally doesn't go in and fight a battle by himself alone because he could be killed. Once he goes in there and he killed Ehud, by some miracle this didn't happen, but Ehud's men would immediately find out and kill him, and then they'd leaderless.
That's very, very true. I'm not saying that's wrong, although I'm going to show you that there's a little problem with who Ehud was in charge of in a second.
Because if Ehud had been an arrogant sort of guy, he wouldn't have been the leader of the subjugated people. He would have had him killed a long time ago.
What do you mean, arrogant in what sense?
Meaning that as the leader of the Jews, you have him portrayed as a heroic figure. And I'm saying as a conquered nation, the guy who brings the presence is hardly a heroic figure. He's a pathetic figure. He is a dominated, subjugated people of which he is the guy who represents them. And it's been going on for years. It's not like there's ever been a rebellion that we can see.
Right. If we go with that, then what we have to do is retranslate a little bit Pasuk Het Vav. Because it says, Vayizakhu b'nei Yisrael el Adonai v'yakem Adonai lahem Moshiach Ehud ben Beirach, which means Ehud is coming out of essentially nowhere. Now, I did show you by Otniel ben Knaz that v'yakem didn't necessarily mean now he's Yakem, but now is that he gets up and moves, which means he's turned from some subjugated leader and a wimp, essentially.
He's had enough.
To a powerful guy. I see Ehud, for a reason which I'll get to in a second, because a leader always needs people, and we're going to find out, very interesting, that Ehud is not leading the people that you would expect him to lead. Ehud, of course, is from which tribe? Binyamin. But Ehud does not lead Binyamites at all. We're going to see why in a second. I have Ehud as being somewhere in between in my mind, and I'm not saying that's necessarily more right than another. He clearly has a history with Eglon. He clearly is the bringer of the Mincha. I'm not sure, if I was a better historian, I would maybe know better whether the king brings the Mincha or whether one of the king's, captains brings the Mincha.
Aren't there all these stelas that have pictures of conquerors being served by the kings of the conquered nations?
Yes, absolutely. And it's certainly possible that he is already the leader of Bnei Israel. There's no question about it. And if that's true, even if you want to go with the fact that he's a leader, there's still a relationship that exists. And then you can say, okay, I know what the relationship is. It's leader to leader. If you don't want to say that, though, I'm still left in a little bind. I don't have a history of Ehud. And it's still weird to me that I would take the leader of another country, or anybody in the country of my enemy, and get rid of everybody as a double agent. I have a hard time with the idea that the king is a double agent, essentially, that he is going to give me information that not only are his people not going to hear, but I don't want any of my people to hear also. It's something so secret that only me, the king, could hear. I'm having a hard time placing Ehud. I can't get a bead on him. All I know is that Eglon for sure knows who he is. Let's continue on and see what else we can find out.
Maybe just a reflection that Eglon is a little bit naive. Maybe he could
Or overconfident.
Naive. He couldn't first one he's confident. He figures, you know, this
who's going to attack him? Well,
you know, he's a pretty successful leader here, 18 years of conflict.
Because he's 18 years successful, he's not very nervous about somebody who might come.
That makes him all the more overconfident.
No, he's not going to think of that threat. And you know, it's a tantalizing thing to tell somebody I've got a secret. You know, you want to know what that secret is. And maybe he's just not that. He wants to hear the secret.
It could be. I tend to think things get more paranoid as time goes on rather than less paranoid. But it's certainly possible. The tête-à-tête, though, it's a little weird, though. I mean, it just strikes me as a little bit weird. Let's continue on, though. Because right now, all these
movies
are possible. What's that?
Happens in the movie. Right? The bad king always sends all the soldiers out before the good guy comes in.
Because otherwise you have no story.
That's right.
So let's assume that this actually happened. What's that?
What? And the music show.
Yes. what parts are we on? I think we're on Klopp. The Eyub Ba'ilav. So Eyub comes to him, but he's got a little problem. The who, that is the king, Yoshev Ba'aliyat HaMekare, he's sitting in an attic, essentially, and Ba'aliyat HaMekare, which is the cold attic, Asher Lo Levado, which he has all by himself, which means, as paranoid as Eglon, as comfortable as Eglon is, Eglon's not that dumb. So essentially, he's in an area that cannot be approached, which means, essentially, Eyub is looking up. There's a ramp. We're going to see there's a big ramp which gets to this separated room, and Moab, the king of Moab, is up there, and Ehud is obviously not going to walk, is not going to enter this aliyah to get to the king. So what does he do? Vayomer Ehud, Devar Elohim Li'elecha. So he says something incredible. He says, I have something of God to tell you. So the guy's sitting on the toilet. He knows, everyone knows he can't hear the word of God while he's sitting on the toilet. Vayakam Yalak Yisei, he gets up on Yalak Yisei. So Eglon, actually, interesting here, is looking like a pretty firm guy. Chazal even mentioned it. Chazal say because he got up from his kisei, so the kisei of David was also established, and from him Eglon's granddaughter or daughter was Ruth, and Ruth would eventually give birth to David. Now that's homiletic. It's a medrash. What it means is it's not pshat. However, what it does indicate is Chazal thinks that what Eglon has done here is a pretty good thing.
Vayishlach
Ehud
at Yad Smolba. Where did he get to get on the bed? He's in the bathroom.
We'll get to it in a second.
Oh, okay.
We'll get to it in a second. Yeah. Vayishlach Ehud et Yad Smolbo. He takes his left hand. And again, it's weird, the precision here. We already know he's a lefty. We know the sword is on his right hand. The precision here is you know, almost like the naturalistic. What was that famous naturalistic author, Zola? Remember Zola, Emil Zola from the late ages, who used to describe people like incorporating in the rivers of France. We get here a detail which is, well, honestly, vomitous. Like you don't see very much. Well, let's read on. And not only vomitous, but just detail. By Shlachah Yehuda Yatzal, so he takes his left hand. It's like a slow motion scene. Takes his left hand. By Yikachet Acheret Me'al Yerachim Yo, and he takes it from him his right. So, and we already know it's on his right. Then why the detail? By Yitka'eha Bibitno, and it goes all the way into his stomach. By Avo Gam HaNitzav Achar Lahav, he presses it in so far that the handle, here you might want to look at the picture, the handle follows the blade. Nitzav is where you hold it, the hilt, and the lahav is the blade. So he pushes it in so far, vayizkora chelev biyada lahav. So the fat of Eglon closes up around the blade. I mean, the detail is just unbelievable. Hilo shalaf acherev bivit bivit, no, he went out of his way not to pull the sword out of Eglon's stomach. Vayetze ha-parshdona. And what came out was the parshdona. No word like this appears in Tanakh anywhere. Anywhere. It's not, you could look high and low for this word, you will not find it. Why use such a word to indicate, apparently, I need to use your imagination. Vayetze ha-parshdona, so his guts fell out. Right. Which, in fact, is how Rashi goes with it, because it feels right. So the way that Rashi explains it is like this. For those who have Rashi, he cuts the word in two parts. Vayetzei Parshdona, Targum Yonatan. Yonatan explains, V'nafak ochle shafich, which means out comes the food and spills. Which is a little bit weird, because we just heard that what had happened, that the blade had gone inside and that nothing went out, that the fat had covered it up. So even if you want to translate it that way, because obviously they're struggling with the translation, Rashi explains what it is. Asa'an kishtei tevot. It made them like two words. Vashin mishameshet l'shtein. And the shin is the split on both words. Which means it shouldn't be a parash dona, it should be a parash shadana. What does that mean, Rashi says? Vayetze ha-peresh, which means the garbage, peresh is like the liquid, the entrails, Shadona, which means l'shadot. L'shadeh means to cast out. Shadot, b'shvicha. Shafach, shadeh, ketarkama. So all of a sudden we got a strange picture. But the weirdest thing about it is, why such gory detail? And why use a word which is not used anywhere else in the Tanakh? Me'av, right, I got that word all over the place. Betem, ochel, dam, I mean, I got all kinds of things. A parshadona, I'm going to use a word which honestly sounds anachronistic. It sounds like it's coming from Achashverosh's time, right? I mean, parshadona has that poetic feel. And here's something very interesting. Vayehud Ehud, Vayetze Ehud HaMizdarona. Ehud goes out to the hallway. Now the Mizdaron was that, essentially a platform that was held up, which allowed you to get from the common area where people saw the king, to the toilet area, which is where Moab sat. By the way, why did Moab, keep in mind, Moab sat on the toilet, which brings us back to Eglon, Melech Moab. Don't forget Baal Peor. The famous Baal Peor is described by Chazal, based on inheritance, is that it was doing one's deeds around, on the god was a part of the worship. That's what Baal Peor means. I forget, pen, or I forget exactly how it works out, but there's an edge there that says part of the worship, and it's not, you know, this is things that we've seen if you go back to, you know, mythologies and even some places today, this is part of the worship, that is with the physical waste.
Leaving yourself on the god.
On the god, that's actually what he did. It's part of, yeah, that was the way they did it. So what's interesting here, though, is look at the poetry. Vayetze Ehud HaMizdarona, Vayetze HaParshadona. So now I can understand why they use the word Parshadona. But then you have to ask yourself, why did they want to create a poetry between Mizdarona and Parshadona? What? Well, almost, right? So why do we want to create the poetry? Why is the word Mizdarona so important that we want to tie Parshadona to Mizdarona? Let's continue on to read that as a question. I think what we do is ask a lot of questions this week. Whether we'll get to the answers, I do not know. So he closes it. I mean, it's so detailed. He closes the door behind him, and he locks it. Even Rashi is a little bit strange here. What does Rashi say? The machteach, with a key. I'm not sure what inspired Rashi to do, you know, with the key. I mean, I'm not sure what Rashi's getting at of it. I don't mean to make fun of Rashi. I'm sure he sees something that I don't, but the detail
he had
here,
the key.
That
again supports that he was a trusted guy who was in around,
maybe.
That he was one of the...
Well,
yeah.
Nobody else be able to get in. They're looking where to get the key.
It's true, but the detail, you're right, and maybe Rashi's trying to enhance the detail.
They're setting the stage here. I mean, like, it's such a crazy story. I mean, this guy goes in to see the king by himself. There are thousands of soldiers, you know, I'm sure, in the courtyard guarding.
Right.
He manages to kill the king and escape. So how does he do it? So they go into all these details. First of all, nobody knows all the guts are coming out, all the blood all over the place. He's in the bathroom, locks the door. So by the time they rouse suspicion.
Not only that, when they open the door, they see him dead. And if there's no blood,
right,
they have no idea that
that's
he was murdered.
That's why you've given us all these details.
I agree with you. You can justify the details as being necessary so that you understand how Ehud managed to escape. And we'll get to that in a second. Ehud managed to escape. He had enough time to gather together a lot of people. They came back. They conquered Ir Tarim. Like, if Ir Tarim had only had 3 hours of warning, we're only talking about 10 kilometers, 10 miles, across a river that Eglon owns. So even if it took them 5 hours to figure it out, the Jews still would not have been able to conquer and destroy the city of Jericho. They would have had a chance to escape, or they would have had a chance to move some troops in there, but they managed to conquer the whole area. They were caught surprised, which means that probably a 24-hour period has gone by before the people can figure out what's happened. And that's true. Then we do need to know that the sword goes all the way in and nothing comes out. What doesn't make sense then is Vayetze HaParshadona. Who cares? You know, I stick it into his belly. And yes, I need to know that the belly closes up so that they don't know that he's murdered he's been murdered. They think he had a heart attack while he's going through them, like an Elvis deal, right? They think it's an Elvis deal. And it takes them a whole day to figure out what's going on. I do not need to know that he pulls the sword from his left. I already know where the sword is. That detail is extraneous. Another detail that's extraneous is Vayetze HaParshadona, that out comes the guts. First of all, they didn't come out. Second of all, maybe it means they spilled, but inside his body. But honestly, who cares? I know he's dead. I don't need details. I don't need all this. Vayetze Ehud HaMizdarona. He goes out by the Mizdaron. Do I mean, where else do you have that Antonov? And Ehud stopped off to read a little bit of newspaper. Then he decided to go down. He goes out the door. He locks the door. What do I need? Vayetze HaMizdarona. You know, it's an incredibly detailed Ehud steps out with his left foot first. So of course he went out that way. Of course he went out.
I don't know. Maybe there was another.
He jumped from the window or something?
Yeah, maybe.
But if he did, who cares?
The whole beauty of the story. That he walked out like nothing happened.
Oh, so that's it. Okay. So Vayetzem is the Rona, is that he casually strolls out, nobody knows. And they see him, he's whistling, he's
the
classic.
That's the beauty of the drama of the story.
I'll absolutely buy it. Although I'm still concerned about the word Vayetzem part of the Rona.
Well, you know, it doesn't say that he killed him.
What?
It doesn't say that he killed him. It doesn't say that he's dead.
Oh, wait, we've got that. Hold on. It's actually a nice thing I like to say. Who yatzav adabah? When his servants come, by Yeru v'hinei dalpot haliyad nu'alot, it's locked. Vayomru, and they said to us, Ach mesich ehu et ragvav, which is also a term for his going to the toilet. Bachadar hamakira, in his cold room. Vayachidu ad bosh, and they wait until it's too late. The word bosh also maybe comes from the word busha, which is that it's an impression of insult to them. They waited so long. V'hinei enel poteh gadot haliyad, vayichu et hamateh, vayichka. But they took the key and they opened it up. V'hinei adonem nofele ha'artzameh. He comes out, he's dead. So now you know he's dead. Why is it important? I'll show you why those words are very important. Ve'hud nimlat ad yitzma'al ha'am, and by the time they were wasting time, v'hu avar et ha'psilim, and once again, this is the second time. Come on, I know he went from the psilim. What do I need to know about the psilim again? If you want to say like the man on the way, he prayed on the way there, what, he stopped off for a prayer on the way back? I mean, okay, I got a major war, I got a jack of this, but let's stop for a quick prayer. I don't think so. So let's continue on. Vayimalei tasirat, and he goes up to the mountains. Mount Seir is another word for mountains.
Oh, is that B?
Not Har Seir, which is Har Adom. No, Seir would also be, it's where the mountains sort of fold. If you've ever gone to Yericho, back in the days we could go, you know those really pillow soft mountains? You ever look, when you're in Yericho, you used to be able to look towards the Jordan, and the mountains are all made out of brown dust. And they look soft. You know, I don't know if you have that image. I'm sorry, I don't have a color picture. It looks like you could put your head on the mountains and just fall asleep. It's a beautiful image. Mir Hashem, next week I'll show you. And that's what's called Hasirata. It's these very softly rolling hills where one hill comes into another and has a wave effect.
That's it.
Yeah, it has the same effect. It looks the same way. It has that same mountainous kind of, it's not rocky. It's sandy, really. And it has this sort of grayish-brown washing effect. I believe so. Also, the idea that mountains that come from a very high place and slowly fold into the desert, that's called Seir. I think it shows up in other places in Tanakh as well. And this is where I have to stop. He blows a horn and he gathers together his people. Where does he gather his people from? So who are his soldiers? From what Shevet? Where's Binyamin? Where's Binyamin? Every Shofet is always a ruler of his own tribe. Every single one except for Otniel ben Knaz. Every single one gathers his own people. Or we don't hear he gathers them at all. This is the only place where we'll see a leader of one tribe, Binyamin, gathering a totally different tribe. And that all of a sudden...
It says he went there and Bnei Yisrael came down with him.
Oh.
He gathered from everyone.
Min Hahar, Vahu Lif Mehav. They came out of the mountain room with them. Yes, it's true, there were probably other tribes there. Probably there was Binyamin there. But I ask you a question. Where is his tribe?
They're working in the quarry.
Har Ephraim is to the north of Beidel. It's dead center in the middle. Har Ephraim is dead center in the middle of Shevet Ephraim, which is a powerful tribe. In fact, Devorah herself comes from Shevet Ephraim. So right after Ehud's gone, the power player of the time would always be Ephraim. Sometimes Menasheh, sometimes Yehuda, but it would always come back to Ephraim as being the power player. Why is Ehud running up to Ephraim to get soldiers? Okay, so he wants more soldiers, but where are his own people?
Ephraim is a bigger tribe?
It is a bigger tribe, no question about it.
Where's
much bigger.
Mitzvah?
The Mitzvah is in Ephraim. We'll meet it when we get to Shul.
That's a big meeting place for
these things. Oh, wait, is it in Ephraim? I'm not so sure. I don't want to say. I don't know. By Yomer, where do you have it on the map?
No.
Yeah, I believe it's in Ephraim, but I'm not sure. By Yomer Aleim, Rishfu Acharai, run after me. Kinatana Danai, by Yechemet Moab, Yechem. Very interesting, by the way. Look at the Lashon. By Yomer Aleim, Rishfu Acharai, Kinatan Adonai et oyvechem et Moab b'yedchem. Does he sound like a king here? Because God has given your enemies into your hands. You see, there's a disconnect here. It's not only a physical disconnect that there's somebody from Binyamin who's calling upon the soldiers of Ephraim. He's even focusing on it by saying, not in the time it'll be Adenu. If you take a look at Dvorah, do you know what it says? Let's look in Dvorah, what she says to Barak. She tells Barak to get up. Pasuk Perek Dalet, Pasuk, a little later on. Where is it? Is that Ted Bug? No?
The Dalad.
Okay, here also she uses that word. She's the soldier. You're absolutely right. So I take it back. I'm not sure we can learn anything from that. Although, and they go after him. They get the fords of the Jordan, the Moab. And they didn't let anybody cross over, which means to support the troops in Israel. Which means they are specifically conquering. They're not conquering past the fords. They're not helping out Reuben and Gad. They've controlled the fords. Nobody can come over. And they've destroyed this west bank of the Jordan River, which would be the Gilgal, the Yericho, and probably a ton of soldiers that have set up in that left hand side. To review the questions, I'd like to know why the detail. I'd like to know what these psyllium are, because as you can see, there's an emphasis on the psyllium. I have a hard time ignoring what psyllium are. If they're quarries, there's no issue. Yeah. But if they're quarries, why use the word psyllium? Yeah. Then why use such a special word?
I still think it's just
okay, I'll see if I can give you something else to pick it up, but it's certainly possible. Yeah, these are my ideas. They're not necessarily for sure.
According to the source is Rashi,
The second problem I have is the detail, the loving detail, especially of the guts. I just don't get it. We just don't get that.
Why that word?
And why such a strange word that they're constructing to match with Mizrona? Why creating? I'll buy that they need to go to Mizrona because you have to see him casually strolling out. But why would I want to rhyme guts with the stroll out?
Maybe it's the Shoma.
No, that's not how anybody understands.
Well.
Okay. I still love. So why? Yeah. Why create such a? You'd have to find a roof that way. No. It's not just one of those, graphic stories. I'll show you something else that actually be. I mean, it could be. Class or something. Sorry, Shane.
It could be. But language. It's all very dramatic.
Why?
Well, you don't get this kind of detail everywhere. But let me see if I give you something.
Dramatic language.
Yeah, this is a little over the top, but I agree. Also, why the focus on the fact that he grabs Ephraim? I'm sorry, I'm rushing just a little bit because we're running out of time. And here I'd like to focus on the first thing that bothered me is Iker Yad Nuno. Because as I mentioned in that email I sent people, I have heard of Iker Yad Nuno. Where does Iker Yad Nuno? He's called a man who is a lefty. And they make a big deal that he's left hand, right hand, bending your knee, Iker Yad Nuno. Not only that, if you look for the Milat Mancha, in the beginning of the Perek Vayigemar, if you look for the word which comes up over and over, it's Rimini. Let's take a look at Pasuk Yud Tetvav. Vayizaku ben Yisrael Adonai vayakom ha-Moshiach Tehud ben Gerai ben Haimini, the son of the Benjamites, Isha Ter Yad Yimino, who's one of the right-handed guys. In the next book, Pasuk, it says, Vayas lo ihad cherev v'lash tei piyot gomer akav vayakor otam mitachon adav al yerech Yimino. Again, you could easily say we need to know it's on his right leg because they probably searched his left leg, which is the usual joint leg, and not his right leg. But it's still a lot of detail, and I feel the word yimini is being made emphasized. But more than that, the word iter yad mino is a word that I'm familiar with. If you've read all of Shoftim, where does it show up? It shows up in Giva. Giva, let me remind you the story. Giva are the ones who acted like Sodom and Amorah. A lady came through his concubine. They wanted to sodomize him. They took his concubine dead instead. They raped her until she died. And then they came out to destroy all of Binyamin. But when all of the Jews got together, and Menachem's right, it's a big sarcastic story. Now the Jews combined together to wipe out a tribe. But how is the tribe described? Please take a look at line on this lot of information page. On line number 39, it talks about the super fighting forces of Binyamin that would wipe out 10 times the amount of soldiers. And from all this amount that I've just told you from Binyamin, there are 700 chosen people, Iter Yadimino, lefties, people who do not use their right hand, Each one could hit a hair, the lo yachti, and doesn't miss. What it's describing here is natural-born killers. These are the best of the best. They are the best shock troops that exist, and they will come together to wipe out large chunks of Jewish people.
They're all left-handed.
But they're not just left-handed. They're described as Iter Yadimino, which is the same description that's used by Ehud. If Ehud is a good guy, and I think you have to admit that he comes off as a great leader, why would it describe the worst of people in the exact same way?
Why are they the worst of people?
Oh, my goodness. They're the people who are... The feeling is that they're from Giba.
The feeling is that they're from Giba, by the way. I see that... I see it as they have this incredible talent left-handed people being left-handed. left-handed people, maybe in those days, they were able to work the weapon exceptionally well.
I agree with you, but again, we have a lot of people. Do I really need to know that exactly 700 people are Iter Yad Mino? Isn't it enough just to say that the Jews had lost and that there were a lot of fighting soldiers? We know the fighting soldiers. There's Kol Ish Bachur. They're the chosen soldiers. I need to know they're left-handed people. Also, keep in mind there's a balance here.
Identified their talent.
And there weren't lefties in the fight against when Gideon fought against Midian. I know they're 300 soldiers. I don't need to know whether they're left-handed or right-handed. So let me leave off with this thought.
Also, Iter Yad Mino describes the specific attribute that you're looking at it. So there's a negative. Everything depends on what your position is when you're looking at it.
But these are the people that killed the Jews.
Because they were so strong.
Well, the Jews were killing them.
No. Also, they're likely from. We said the 400 of the best soldiers came from Giba, which was the very place that committed the sodomy. 700 people were Iter Yad Mino. So at least some of these soldiers were the sodomites. I'm running out of time, so I just want to point out something else interesting, and I will let you think about it, and then next week we'll finish some of these ideas up. Take a look on line number 7 of the whole story that starts off the Giba. The lady walks into town, and they rape his Pilegesh. Please, let's take a look and see something very interesting. V'hinei ish zakein bav ima'asehu. There's one nice guy in the city who's going to protect the lady walking through. Where is he from? He's living in Binyamin, in a place called Giba, but he's from Har Binyamin. So the first question that Rashi immediately asks is, why does it say Bnei Yimini? We know Giva is from Yehuda. From Binyamin. It says in Pasuk Yud Dalet, Eitzel Giva Shelo Binyamin. Why do we have to know Ben Yimini? So take a look at the Radak underlined. V'yesh Omer Ki Omer Ben Yimini. What is Ben Yimini? Ki Bechezkat Ra'im Hayu. They were bad people. By the way, don't forget, please, how did Binyamin get his name? His father named him Binyamin, but what did his mother name him? Ben-Oni. Now I want to show you something else. Take a look at and I'll end with this, on line 18 of this page. This is after they find the girl raped. And by the way, he lies. The lady lies. What actually happens, it is terribly cynical, he throws his Pilegesh out, which he never repeats later on when he's telling Pilegesh out. He throws his Pilegesh out, and then he goes to sleep, and then he gets up in the morning and says, oh, she's dead, who cares? And then he goes home, and then after he's home, he decides to cut it off. We'll study in a month from now how bad this guy is, but look at the words. Vayakam Adoneha Baboker, her master gets up. Vayiftach Daltot Habayit, Vineha Ishav Pilegesho Naflav Petach Habayit. Please take a look now at our story. I gave you Pasuk Kafei in our story right below that, line 22 and line 24. Compare that to line 18. Now take a look at the end of line 25. And now take a look at line 19. The words there are strikingly similar. In one pasuk in Pilegesh Begiva, we have essentially exactly the same words that are used in pasuk Kafei in one pasuk by Giba. Now, if Eglon here is being compared to Eglon, who is being compared to in this case? The Pilegesh, then the killer of the Pilegesh, then Ehud, the killer of Eglon, is being compared to the Sodomites. It's hard, tough, huh? But But the psukim are difficult to ignore, aren't they?
Okay, but then contrast them.
What's that?
Same
author
reuse the same language.
No, no. Can't be. Nehar Ephraim and Binyamin and Benimini and Ben-Oni. See, everybody is...
They're contrasting the story.
Sorry, I'll read you one more thing and then I'll go. When does the Pilegus Begiva story happen? We all tend to think because it's at the end of the book, it happens at the end. I'll read you this Rashi and then I'll call it quits because we're going over time. Vayhi Ish Mehar Ephraim. This is the Micha story. By the way, what's the centerpiece of the Micha story? The Pesel. Afal Pi Rashi says, Shenichta Parshil Kalalo B'Sofa Sefer. Even though these stories are written at the end of the Sefer Shel Micha, Vishal Pilegus Begiva, B'Techilat HaShoftim Haya, B'Mei Othniel Ben Knaz. It was in Othniel Ben Knaz's day. Which means what happened to the tribe of Binyamin during Othniel Ben Knaz's time? They were destroyed. Why does Ehud no longer go to his people? Because there are no people. Why would Eglon trust a Benyamini to bring back bad word about the Jewish people? What we're going to start to do next week is we're going to develop a history of Ehud Ben Gera, and we're going to see that if you put him after the story of Gibeah, it wasn't that they were calling the people who Gibeah who were killers after Ehud. Ehud was in fact one of the... Ehud was one of the 700 soldiers that survived the battle. What? People are very black and white, don't you think? People are not black and white. People are very gray. Listen, I realize this is a shocker. And there's no question that he was a good shofet. But there are no black and whites. There is a very gray. And you take this Rashi as it is, and it changes the whole story. Are there psilim in Israel? You better believe there are psilim at the wazoo. What happened to Shevet Binyamin? They were destroyed. What happened to a city in God? By the way, Eglon walks into God and seems to destroy them completely. What happened to Yavesh HaGilad? Remember, on the other side, it was destroyed by the Jewish people, and they stole their wives. If you put these stories in front of Ehud Ben Gera, and Ehud Ben Gera follows on the path of destruction of his own tribe, I believe it will change some of what's going on in the story. So I think maybe I should have started off with that, but it's more fun to surprise you. Anyway, this is certainly my opinion. I'm a little out on a limb, because as you can see, I have some negative things to say about Ehud Ben Gera, the assassin. I have some things. I'm going over time.
Who better to choose to kill the king?
By the way, I hate to do this, but if we match up the word Vayetze HaParshdona to Vayetze HaMizdorona, alright, what is Yetze HaMizdorona? Ehud. What is Yetze HaParshdona? Whatever's coming out of Eglon. Also, not necessarily a positive image. That is, the murder is somehow contrasted with Ehud's casual waltzing out after committing an assassination. I'm definitely going to get beaten up on this, but I'll get beaten up last week, and I'm already over time, and I apologize.